Good evening. Thank you for stopping by and visiting Cryptoville. I'm your host, Susan McNally, and I'm glad you could join us this evening as we discuss the mystery of the Russian Yeti and whether, in light of the recent TV program about it, the mystery has been solved. This podcast is based on an article I published on the visitcryptoville.com website. So if you ever want to go over any details and check out pictures or videos that I refer to, you'll find them there. The music we're enjoying in the background is called Moonlight Hall and is provided by Kevin MacLeod. The title of tonight's topic is Russian Yeti. Is the Dyatlov mystery solved? About a week ago, Discovery Channel ran a program called Russian Yeti, The Killer Lives, that came to some very interesting conclusions about what happened to 9 students in the wilds of the Ural Mountains back in 1959. So, tonight we're going to investigate this mystery and the program and see what kind of conclusions we can draw. The story begins on the night of February 2nd, 1959, in the desolate area of the Ural Mountains. 9 students and graduates of the former Ural Polytechnic Institute, now Ural Federal University, met a mysterious and deeply disturbing end. They had gone hiking into the wilds of the Ural Mountains, hoping to reach Otorten Mountain. This hike was considered a Category 3 hike, and as all the students were experienced hikers and skiers, they hoped to accomplish this goal. On the night they died, they were about 6 miles from the targeted mountain, Otorten. When the first search party arrived, and this was 3 weeks or so after the tragedy, they found the students' abandoned tents, and inside was survival gear such as heavy boots, warm outerwear, knives, things they could have used to help themselves survive. They found deliberate cuts in the tents, which these investigators were able to determine were made from the inside. And some speculated that they were made so that they could see what was stalking them outside. And that's because they followed that line of thought because they thought if something was out there frightening them, making noise, and in the pitch black they couldn't see it, they were trying to at least get some kind of a view of the thing and hence cut the slits in the tent. Interestingly, the tent doors were still buttoned shut, according to one of my sources, so ultimately the students cut their way out of the tent. And let's just remember, back then they did have zippers, but apparently the tents were buttoned still, which is a little weird, but, you know, I can see if you're in a panic wanting to cut your way out rather than fiddling with buttons, you know? And the conditions that these students found themselves in, a desolate mountain area, temperatures below freezing, and we're talking like minus 22 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 30 degrees Celsius, and they're in the pitch black darkness. In all the accounts of this reports that I've read, no one ever mentioned a flashlight being found. And I find that strange because I happen to know they did have flashlights back then, and I can't imagine going on some kind of survival hike and not bringing one with you. So, I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. Ultimately, the searchers found the bodies. And the 2 of the young men died of hypothermia next to a small fire that they had built on the edge of the forest. Well, what was weird about that was the wood that they were burning came from branches that were taken from 16 feet up in the trees. That's 5 meters. 16 feet up. The researchers speculated that they must have climbed the tree to see if they could find their camp and return to it. But of course, it also occurs to me that if something was attacking them back at the camp, maybe they climbed the tree to see if they could possibly tell if it was still around, even in the dark. And I think something else to note, you know how they say don't burn green wood? I wonder if they had to climb that high to find some dead wood that they could break off and use for the fire. I don't know, it's not clear. As much of this story, it's not clear. So we'll move on. Three more students, two males and one female, were found in a row as though they were trying to get back to their tent. One of them had a cracked skull, but he died of hypothermia along with his two companions. The rest were found in a dugout snow cave they had made as though they were hiding from something. Now, that's what some people had said. It looked like they were hiding from something. But I also have to wonder, well, maybe they were just huddled together because of the cold and they were trying to keep warm. Again, right now, it's not clear to us. It's something we can't say definitively one way or the other. But what we do know is that this group had sustained broken bones and serious internal injuries, all without cuts or marks on their skin, which is weird. The man who examined the corpses, his name is Dr. Boris Vazrodeni. Well, he concluded that three of the students died from fatal injuries so severe that he felt it was outside the realm of possibility that a human could have caused them. The man who was in charge of figuring out overall what happened to these people was Lev Ivanov, and he is a Soviet investigator. Well, per my research, it said that he had trouble coming to any real conclusions himself, so he decided he was going to write that what killed the students was, and this is a quote, an unknown elemental force which they were unable to overcome, unquote. Now, how is that for a bureaucratic explanation? Other translations that I saw of his conclusions stated it this way, quote, a compelling unknown force, unquote, that is what killed the students. Well, okay, that makes more sense, I think. A compelling unknown force. Well, sure. One of my sources said that Mr. Ivanov privately felt that they were actually killed by UFOs. So, and why would he feel that way? Well, we're going to get into the lights in the sky. But before we go there, I want to mention that one of the things we learned from the Discovery Channel program is that the first researchers on the scene saw huge footprints around the camp. They weren't human footprints. They looked more like Bigfoot prints. And this is what I'm saying based on the photos that they showed. They took photos of them, but the photos were covered up with all the other information and subsequent data collected from these investigations way back in the day. So, in other words, they're only recently coming to light. Other theories have suggested that the students may have been killed by escapees from a nearby, put that in quotes, gulag camp. The gulag camps were places of extreme hardship where political dissidents were sent to die. And these camps were located near the Mountain of the Dead, as it's called. My first thought is, do political dissidents usually kill people? I mean, I know they may be starving, but they could still talk and ask for food. I don't know that they necessarily would resort to killing. I think that's a weak argument. And also, it seems unlikely that they would have been able to escape given the circumstances and brutality of the Russian judicial system. And let's not forget where they were, you know, desolate, frozen, barren land. They were probably having this, if they escaped, they would have been having as hard a time to survive as the students. I think the point we should note that is that there were no other animal footprints around the camp. Just the students' footprints and the Bigfoot Yeti footprints, per the photographic evidence. And I have to say at this point, one thing I find a little strange, in other reports they say, well, yes, no bear prints, no other animal prints were found. And yet, we also learned that the student bodies were covered with snow. In other words, there had been interim snowfall by the time the search and rescue crew got there. So if their bodies were covered with snow, would that be enough snow to cover up the footprints that had been made? I think it probably would have. I mean, we're talking at least 4 inches. And yet, you know, they were still able to find Yeti prints and the students' footprints. Well, it's possible, I suppose, that the snow just didn't fall over the area of the camp. And another thing I was thinking, per the Yeti print, you know, maybe the Yeti was a Johnny-come-lately to the scene and had absolutely nothing to do with it, you know, and its footprints were the freshest and the most recent, and so that's why it got people thinking about perhaps that might have been part of the, you know, demise of these students. So, I don't know. Again, you see, it's just, things still aren't clear, and in my opinion, even in the aftermath of this TV program, there's still a lot of fuzzy, hazy evidence, quote-unquote. Well, let's move on. Again, according to the TV program, something happened that caused the students to flee together about a mile away from their camp into the cover of the nearby forests. Now, if you saw the show, you could see that they had been camping on, like, what I would call a flat, windswept sort of plain, and the forest was, I guess, a mile to one side of them. And I don't know why they didn't camp down in the shelter of the forest, but people have various theories about that, and that they relate to hiking at that altitude, and so we don't need to get into that. It's more techie stuff. But at any rate, the researchers seem to indicate that the students fled en masse from their camp altogether to one area, and after that, they broke up into smaller groups. Interestingly, one of the last photos that they took was very blurry, but it showed two big spots of light in the sky. Now, someone on the show who was an expert commentator explained what he thought they were. He felt that the light dots in the sky were actually the airburst of a two-stage rocket that crashed in that area just as the students were camping there. And it may explain why eventually the KGB got involved in the mystery and covered the whole thing up. And if it was a rocket, it may also explain why there were high levels of radiation on some of the students' clothes. Previous to this, or learning this, some people thought that UFOs must have attacked and killed the students based on the fact that there were lights in the sky seen in the area the night they died. And in fact, somewhere, if it wasn't the program mentioning it, it was in one of the articles I read, there was another group of campers about 50 miles from where the students were camped, and they saw the lights in the sky as well the same night. So that's good to know. It adds a little credence that, yeah, there was something there, and other people saw it too. Now, they say that the Soviets were using that area as a missile test range in the 1950s. And I think that's probably likely. Remote, desolate, you know. And I think the missile explanation is more plausible than UFOs being involved in the students' deaths. And as we know, missiles can produce plenty of strange phenomena in the sky, the least of which is lights. You know, in the last couple years, or within the last couple years, there was a major incident over Norway. I don't know if you remember it or saw it, but a Russian rocket malfunctioned and exploded. And the way the rocket fuel exited the craft, it was in a spiral formation, which was then backlit from the explosion and burning of the rocket. And it made a colossal night sky display. And everyone was saying, UFO, UFO, it must be a UFO. But we shortly thereafter learned it was the explosion of a Russian test rocket and not a UFO at all. So, yeah, things can go wrong with these tests and these rockets then and now. In a wiki article that I read on the subject, and by the way, if you'd like to read more about all of this, I have the list of references that I used on the bottom of my article on visitcryptoville.com. So if you go to visitcryptoville.com, the homepage on the right-hand side, you'll see a search box. Put in Russian Yeti, and it'll call this article up, scroll down, and you'll see the list of references, and then you can read it to your heart's content. But anyway, in this wiki article, they mentioned that a man named Yuri Kuncevich, who, by the way, began and still runs the Dyatlov Foundation, which is dedicated to finding out, you know, what really happened to these students and also to memorialize them. Well, he said that he attended the funerals of five of the hikers. Now, at the time, he was 12, and he said that he remembers that their skin was colored a deep brown tan. Now, all you have to do is look at a picture of these students to see that they're lily white. You know, living in the northern climes, they are white as snow themselves. So it's unusual to see them with a deep brown tan. Could that have been radiation burns? Maybe. But it might also have been part of the decomposition process that their bodies underwent, especially in those extreme conditions. But for me, it just adds a little more credence to the missile malfunction and subsequent explosion, especially when you take it with the fact that they actually did find high radiation levels on some of the students' clothing. Now, there was one member of this group that originally set off who had to turn back after a day or so. His name was Yuri Yudin, and because of that, he survived. He wasn't part of this. And he reported that he knows for certain that his friend's organs were put in boxes and sent for analysis. He saw them. And in my mind, this would further indicate the authorities were studying the effects of radiation on the students' bodies. I don't know if that's part of a normal autopsy. If it is, well, then that's probably what it is. But it might also be, you know, related to the radiation exposure. You might be wondering, well, this all happened in 1959. Why is this all being dredged up again? Well, much of what we know, this is per the TV program, comes from the students' own diaries that they left behind. And last night's show revealed a one-liner from one of the girls' diaries that read, and this is a quote, "Now we know the snowman exists," unquote. And you know, it has to be said, it did seem that the students were taking a lot of pictures of the forest, not necessarily anything in particular, for instance, like a beautiful composition or something. They just were sort of snapping a lot of things in images of the forest, as though they were trying to catch something or get a glimpse of something. And still, you know, I think to myself, well, why hadn't we heard this before, especially as this guy has his foundation going? But I guess, you know, it's happening in Russia. It doesn't make it to the U.S., you know. And if he doesn't have computer access, well, then we're not going to know about it. Excuse me. Well, then we were shown a photograph that was slightly blurred of what looks like, looks exactly like a Bigfoot off in the woods. In fact, it reminded me very much of Patty from the Patterson-Gimlin film. In a different pose, but, you know, the same body type. They had a forensic video analyst, and I'm sorry I can't remember their title, look at the photos. And she concluded that the photo was real, definitely authentic, and hadn't been tampered with. And it seemed to help that they had the original negatives with, you know, that they could compare it to. And the negatives, which had been stored away God knows where, were still connected. You know how it used to be with rolls of film? The negatives were all connected to each other. So that all seems, according to the show anyway, to lend credibility to this photograph that, yeah, they did finally catch an image of the snowman, or as we would say, Yeti or Bigfoot. We have to look at the era in which this disaster occurred, I think. You know, at the height of the Cold War between the United States and Russia, rumors abounded and no clear answer was available back in the day. And let's face it, they did not have the forensics that we're able to do today. So the Soviets did what people in those days usually did. They secreted all the evidence away into some obscure vault and left it there to turn to dust. Now, let's get back to this creature supposedly caught on the film. The First Nations people living in that area where the students lost their lives are called the Mansi. And they were interviewed for this TV program. At the time of the search and recovery of the students' bodies, some people suspected the Mansi of killing them. And that's because in the past there were incidents between the Mansi and Russians fighting over various things. Well, in fact, at least one of the students' diaries mentioned a big fight that one of them had with the Mansi, but it turns out that the Mansi were just trying to warn the students away from the Mountain of the Dead, as they call it. Further supporting their innocence, the doctor who had examined the bodies firmly stated that the injuries perpetrated on some of the students could not have been caused by a human being because of the force involved in executing the blows. But we did learn something very interesting. The Mansi know about a forest giant they call the Menk, M-E-N-K. And it sounds very much like a Bigfoot. They describe it as big and strong. They said it hunts deer and it likes to rip out the deer tongues and eat them. The Mansi woman reporting this also said they make a horrible whistling sound, and she seemed to be spooked just talking about it. She said the Menk don't like when humans whistle in the woods, so they don't whistle. The Mansi people don't whistle in the woods. Now, a chilling fact from the original investigation states that Ludmilla, one of the students, was found with her tongue ripped out. There was a lot of blood in her stomach, which means she was still alive after it had been ripped out of her mouth. Ugh. The Mansi woman interviewed for the program believes that the students were all killed by the Menk. And she said that their people have reported they know of other people who have gone missing without explanation throughout that area. And presumably they attributed the people's disappearance to the Menk. You know, I've said this to my readers before. I take the testimony of Native peoples very seriously. They aren't idiots. They know their environment. And they have nothing to gain from talking about it. I mean, this is not a Western culture that can have their 15 minutes of fame, you know, get their video on YouTube and, you know, have some more fame and notoriety that way. No. I mean, they gain absolutely nothing from it. And I think this Mansi woman may be right. Maybe this Bigfoot / Yeti / Menk was involved. But I don't think it's the whole answer. Mike Lebecki, who is described as an American explorer, is the one who, I guess I won't say hosted the show, but guided us through the TV program. He's the one who set about doing the show to find out once and for all what happened to them. And his motivation was this, from his own lips, and I quote, "I've spent a lot of time alone in the mountains and have had my share of near-death experiences. I know if I went missing, I'd want my family to know what happened to me," unquote. Okay, that's a compelling opening, and, you know, we're left in no doubt as to his motivation and intentions. He hired a translator named Maria Klenikova, who I think is also a journalist. I saw her, well, we all did on the program. It looked like she was on a news set, but maybe she was just translating. I don't know. And I have to say, I enjoyed watching the program, but some things were just nagging at my mind, and I was concerned about them. Part of their adventure, particularly when they were looking for the Yeti nest in that cave, it seemed contrived. If the film crew refused to stay there overnight, well, where did that other footage come from? Albeit it wasn't great, it wasn't a lot. I guess they must have had handheld cameras that they could use themselves, but the other thing about that is, I also didn't think the sound they heard was very convincing. You know, let's call it a monster call, if you will. I think it sounded very much like the one I've heard on another program, and perhaps you've caught this one too, Mountain Monsters. It's my opinion that Mountain Monsters, the whole thing, I think it's fabricated. You know, I'm... If it's not exactly scripted, they sort of follow a story. I mean, and for a lot of reasons. I mean, every episode they catch or almost catch their intended, you know, victim. And yet, look at finding Bigfoot. They've been on for, what, 3 or 4 years, and they still haven't found him? So, I mean, I find that implausible, you know? But what they do have is the pure entertainment factor. I mean, those guys are crazy. And actually, I watch them because it's so crazy. But nonetheless, I heard that same call that we heard on the Russian Yeti program recently on Mountain Monsters programs, supposedly the calls of those various creatures. So I'm disturbed that this monster call heard in the cave and at other points in the Russian Yeti show, it sounded canned to me, quite frankly. Needless to say, skeptics are all over this program, panning the assumption that a Yeti attacked their camp and severely injured some of them. One critic suggested that the force of an avalanche hitting Ludmilla while she was screaming is what ripped out her tongue. Now I ask you, if you get hit with an avalanche while you're screaming, maybe you bite a piece of your tongue off. It doesn't rip the tongue out of your throat. Because, you know, our tongues go back into our throats quite a way. Oh, it's silly. Despite there being no evidence of an avalanche, by the way. I mean, in the research that I read, people did check, and they didn't see any evidence whatsoever of an avalanche at that time. So, you know, I'm thinking to myself, it's easy to criticize from a lighted, heated home office. And frankly, I'm that way too. That's how I work. I'm not out in the field, and I'm looking at all these reports. But the thing is, I'm sympathetic to the cryptozoology side of things, and I do believe in Bigfoot. So, you know, I'm just trying to get to the truth. I'm trying to be logical, rational, and as scientific as we can be with these things. So, that aside, for me, the main problem with the show is Discovery Channel's lack of credibility. And I know that might sound harsh, but remember, these are the people that gave us the Megalodon show. And I can't tell you how many believe that that really is true, that we know for sure that Megalodon is out there. And, you know, maybe he is. But scientists don't have that awareness or knowledge yet, if ever. And until they do, I'm going to be skeptical about it. And I'd also like to point out, Discovery Channel owns Animal Planet. And do you remember their Mermaids movie? Pure fiction. And they did put it in somewhat small print on their website. I checked it out before the first running of the Mermaids movie. Because, of course, like everyone else, I was intrigued by it. But they said, you know, that it was fiction and scripted and that there were actors playing the parts. So, you've got to be careful. And now we have the Russian Yeti program. And I'm left scratching my head wondering, how much of it can we really believe? I think they make an excellent case as to why the lights in the sky may have been there. Mike Glebecki cited 3 other times that a Yeti purportedly attacked humans, and each time it was when the Yeti was provoked. So he concluded that the exploding missile that we spoke about before provoked the Yeti enough that he or it attacked the students. Frankly, I think that's more plausible than the UFO theory, because why would a UFO come down out of nowhere and start attacking? I mean, it's not like they took them away to do research on them or, you know, said something meaningful to them to take me to your leader. No, nothing like that. Just to shoot them and knock them down and kill them? That completely doesn't make sense. So, as for the Yeti, I think it's very likely that there is a Yeti that exists in the wilds of Russia, and I think it's probably another relative of Bigfoot on the hominid family tree, you know? But of course, skeptics aren't going to believe that either. My main concern is with these quote-unquote newly uncovered files and secret archives. Are they real? Are their contents real? And can we believe that photo of the Bigfoot in the forest is real any more than we can believe in the canned monster call? And I've also been wondering, if in fact that area was a missile range test site back in the day, how is it that the Mansi, the native people there, weren't sickened by the radiation fallout? I don't know, it's all a bit hazy to me. I think the bottom line is this. The program made a good case for how the students died that fateful night in 1959. The trouble is, can we believe it? And then how many of us can afford to go to Russia and start researching and investigating everything Mike Lebecki did? I'm going to guess few to none of us, right? Especially in this economy. So it's hard to draw any definite conclusions. Do I think a Yeti really exists? Yes, I do. I know Brian Sykes found evidence of an extinct polar bear and not a Yeti. Do you remember when they had that whole big DNA, call for DNA and big testing, and he got all these samples, I guess, and he did one test. So he found the evidence for an extinct polar bear. It's not a Yeti. But that only means the sample he got wasn't from a real Yeti. It was from an extinct bear. And by the way, that's also interesting and exciting, too. Could the lights in the sky on February 2nd, 1959 have been from the failed missile test? Sure, because the Cold War really happened, and Russian secrecy is legendary. And then in recent times, as I said, we've seen many examples of rockets or missile tests of theirs fail spectacularly. So it's certainly possible. So will we ever really know, though, what happened to these students? The full story? I think perhaps, but not quite yet. And I think what needs to happen is a corroboration and rechecking of these theories by people who have the authority to evaluate them, preferably people not associated with a network. Only when we have multiple reports saying the same thing can we begin to believe it is fact. That's called science. So, while I found the show very intriguing and interesting and got me thinking, as well as everyone else who watched the show, I don't know if we can believe it verbatim. And I think we need to be cautious and wait and see if there's any further developments, if any scientists get involved and can weigh in on some of this or not. Now, I'd love to know what you think, but as I always say, I'm not set up to take phone calls or anything like that. Excuse me. But there are still three ways that you can reach me. So let's run over those. Via email, and that address is cryptoville@hotmail.com, C-R-Y-P as in Paul, T as in Thomas, O-V-I-L-L-E @hotmail.com. Then you can pop over to the website, that's visitcryptoville.com, and put in the search bar Russian Yeti. It'll pull up this article, and at the very bottom you can leave comments, and I'll get back to you. And finally, I'm also on Facebook, so if you get on Facebook, type in Cryptoville, and it'll call up the page, and you can just, you know, enter your thoughts and comments, and we'll respond and get back to you. Thank you for joining us in Cryptoville this evening. Visit Cryptoville to find more podcasts on different topics. If you look at the articles by topic drop-down menu, again in the top right, and you select Cryptozoology Podcasts, you'll come to them. I'll be making more soon.